Thanks, everyone, for being here. I will start this talk in a very unconventional way by saying a few words about what I'm not going to talk about. So this happened yesterday. You all saw it. It's very exciting. Now seeing 3 detectors, which opens up a whole lot of new interesting physics to be done. But I'm not going to talk about this. I will talk about something else. Though, if you have any questions about the new gravitational wave announced, let me know. We can discuss it. OK. So back to what I am going to talk about in this talk. I will talk about neutron star coalescences rather than the black holes that LIGO has already seen, about 4 of them. I will talk about neutron stars. And when neutron stars coalesce, the final object is not going to be the clean black hole we expect from vacuum mergers, because matter is involved in the coalescence. And when matter is involved, of course, everything is much more complicated. So when 2 neutron stars coalesce, they could end up in a remnant that is a neutron star or a black hole. And depending on what this remnant is after the collision, different emission is expected from this system. So I will talk about this kind of emission, what happens after 2 neutron stars have coalesced. And I will describe a new approach to study this signal in a, what we call a model agnostic way. So I'm going to start a little bit with LIGO data analysis. I want to describe a little bit how LIGO analyzes the data it gets so that I can explain what we do different and what I mean by a model agnostic approach. So LIGO parameter estimation is basically one big exercise in applying Bayes' theorem as many times as you can. So you get some data, D, in this equation, and what you eventually want to calculate is what the probability that some model what the probability is that some model describes the data. So if you have some model for what the waveforms, how the signal looks like, the probability that this model is correct is given by Bayes' theorem, which tells you that it's equal to the likelihood of the data, which is basically the probability that you got the data given that the model is correct, times a prior for your signal up here. These are usually the important terms in Bayes' theorem that we talk about. We usually leave out this term here called the evidence. For what I'm going to talk about here, the evidence is just normalization factor, though it can become interesting in certain studies. So this is what we're attempting to do. And schematically, this is a plot from the 170104 gravitational wave announcement, the paper. So in the top, you see the strain seen by the detector as a function of time. And in the bottom, you see the residual. So the analysis is basically described schematically in this plot. A gravitational wave hits the detector responds in some way and adds Gaussian noise on top of that. So the data in orange and blue for the 2 detectors in the top panel are just the signal that hit the detector plus some noise. And then what we do, if we want to analyze this data stream, we make an educated guess for what the signal looks like. Let's say it's H prime. We subtract this educated guess from the data, and presumably, if our guess is good, we are left with noise. So what's left here is just noise. So basically, data analysis and LIGO, parameter estimation, model selection, searches, is just an attempt to model the noise as well as you can. The standard choices for what the noise looks like is that it's stationary and Gaussian, which is a fairly good approximation most of the time. So then you can write down the likelihood of the data is just Gaussian that we all have seen many times. And this is where the data comes in, how the data affects your measurement. But there is another ingredient in this whole process, which is the prior. So Bayes' theorem also always includes priors. You need to come up with a prior for what the signal looks like, what you saw in the detector, where does it come from, what does it look like, how much are you allowed to assume about it.
Where is IJs? I mean, this is the
So this is summation. What you do, you have a time series or a frequency series, and IJ is a different time or frequency bins. And C here is just the correlation matrix between noise in different times or different frequency bins. Okay, so the likelihood is kind of a done deal. We kind of understand the noise. What is important, and what I'm going to talk about in this talk, basically, is the prior. What do we do with the prior for the signal?
So if I may interrupt, I mean, it is true that at low frequencies, you don't have Gaussian noise, right?
Sorry?
At low frequencies, the noise is not Gaussian.
The non-Gaussianity of the noise comes in the form of various transients, which we call glitches, and there are different tests to capture them. So people monitor the detector constantly and capture them and have categorized a large number of them. So what happens is usually they pinpoint that something happened and subtract this, veto this chunk of data. So what we end up analyzing is the rest, is what happens when nothing weird seems to be happening in the detector, which is Gaussian at the end of the day. But yes, we do have lots of transients that are not astrophysical.
So those are kind of big non-Gaussian events that you can actually identify, but there could be a small ones that are not easy to. And I'm just saying that these are LIGO papers. There's at low frequencies, you look at the variance divided by the Gaussian prediction, you see that at low frequencies it shows up. And I mean, as long as you don't care about low frequencies, maybe this is okay, but it is what it is. Yeah.
The low frequency where we analyze data does vary. So the instrumentalists do tell us we trust data above this frequency. So yes, at low frequency, we slowly move to lower and lower frequencies. So yes, there are issues, but we're not analyzing the data where we know the instrumentalists tell us there are issues. Okay, the prior. So, The standard analysis that was used for the binary black holes and is the most simple, intuitive way of analyzing data that you can think of is what we call template-based search. This is basically the strongest prior you can think of. Make a very good, very precise guess of what the signal looks like. An example, of course, is just a binary black hole waveform. This is kind of the templates that were used to analyze the first gravitational wave events, and then the prior ends up being essentially a delta function. You're only searching for things that are exactly your model. And your model is parameterized by some parameters that are, you know, the masses, the spins of the black hole, the sky location, the orientation of the source. And you end up looking only for things that match this model that you have decided to use. This prior is very strong because you're only looking for certain things. So because it's so strong, it's not as flexible. If what you have seen is not exactly what you're looking for, you might miss it or you might bias your parameters, but it is strong. It's a very strong prior, so it will give the best results. It will give the most sensitive results if it is correct. The second approach, which is what I'm going to talk about today, is a more generic approach where you don't use such strong of a prior for what the signal looks like. So it's a more flexible approach that can model things that you don't quite expect, but of course it's less sensitive. It's not able to capture as much information from a signal as if you knew exactly what the signal was. And the general idea here is that you decompose any signal as a sum of basis functions. If your basis functions are chosen appropriately, you can essentially reconstruct any signal. It's just the simple, for example, Fourier decomposition of a function. You use a sum of basis functions, and an appropriate sum of these functions can result in anything you want. So essentially, the prior, in this case, is again a delta function over this sum, but the model is so flexible that it can capture anything with an appropriate sum of basis functions. And the specific implementation I'm going to talk about and use in this analysis is called Bayes wave. It was an algorithm that was constructed a few years ago by Neil Cornish and Tyson Lindenberg, which its name describes exactly what it's doing. It's a Bayesian code. It does model selection parameter estimation in the Bayesian framework, and it decomposes the signal in a sum of wavelets. This basis function does not have to be fixed. It's very flexible. You can choose whatever you want. But in its current incarnation, Bayes' wave uses more like a Bohr wavelets, which are essentially signed Gaussians. They have, this is the basic equation for a more like a Bohr wavelet. It is cosine times a Gaussian envelope. It has five parameters, depends on five parameters, an amplitude, a quality factor that tells you how fast it decays, and a central time, frequency, and phase. So at the end of the day, you're trying to analyze a signal by assuming it's a sum of wavelets that look something like that. And because a sum of wavelets is a very flexible model, in fact, it's an overcomplete basis, not a complete basis, but it's not a big problem for us here, you end up with an analysis that's very robust against systematic errors. Yes, you are using a model, but you're using a model that's so flexible that can capture anything that's in the detector.
So you said it's not a complete basis, but you also said it's not a problem. So why is that?
It's an overcomplete basis. And it's not a problem because we are not attempting to analyze its element of the basis separately. What we do is we reconstruct the signal, and from the reconstruction, we try to extract information. The overcompleteness would be a problem if we were reconstructing the signal and then looking at the individual wavelets that went into the signal and tried to interpret the individual wavelets. If you try to do something like that, that would be a problem. But we're not doing this exactly because it's an overcomplete basis. And you can cut some corners there, of course, and say, I can maybe do that, it's not too much of a problem, but if you want to be exact, you don't look at the individual wavelets that went into the signal. And at this point, you might start getting worried that we are going to model everything. And I will try to convince you that we're not going to model everything. Once you have something, a signal and a Gaussian noise, if you start trying to model it with wavelets, in principle, you can model everything. You can throw in 1,000 wavelets and model everything. The way around it is by using something called a technique called a reversible jump Markov chain Monte Carlo, which is a normal Monte Carlo, Markov chain Monte Carlo method, but that it has power, it has say over how many wavelets you're going to use. So if...
I'm sorry. I guess I'm a little bit confused about the statement about wavelets. So there is a scale tau there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you choose tau wrong, you said the basis is over complete, but it probably not quite true. Because if I have, say, quasi-normal modes, and the scale at which my quasi-normal modes decay is much larger than tau, you shouldn't be able to reconstruct it with your wavelets. So there is some additional information that goes into this wavelet basis, right? So your wavelet basis is, you know, exponentially decaying signal. And so if it decays faster than my quasi-normal modes, you shouldn't be able to reconstruct.
Then what the algorithm will try to do is not just use one wavelet, it will try to use a second wavelet. If one wavelet does not capture your signal very well, it will try to use a second, which is exactly the step I'm about to describe here.
I'm still confused.
So you're going to change the parameters. What are you going to change the value?
Is tau fixed?
No, nothing is fixed.
So tau, but it's just because it was not in there. If you go one change back.
You call it Q.
Okay.
This Q is basically 1 over tau.
Okay.
It's the quality factor how fast it decays. I'm not very consistent between the right and the left side. Apologies for that, but yes. Q is what gives you, the quality factor gives you power.
Allow it to change anything.
Yes, we allow everything to change. We even allow this to change, the number of wavelets we use. And don't care about that. We allow the number of wavelets that we change to use. So at its core, what the algorithm does, it gets a signal. It tries to fit it, say, with 3 wavelets. It gets a pretty good fit. And then it tries, how about 4? What if I give it 4? if the fit is better, it might keep the fourth wavelet. If the fit is worse, it won't keep the fourth wavelet. This is an inherent quality of Bayes factor, that of a Bayes theorem. It has an inherent outcome penalty when you try to add more and more into your signal. When you increase the dimensionality of the signal, it does not like it. So you have to really justify the need for an extra wavelet, for an extra parameter, for everything you try to model. So it is robust against systematics, and it's also robust against overfitting.
So here is the query. I thought you were going to say this. So the Diodes noise curve is a mess.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to that, there is a true signal. So wouldn't you have a template set or a wavelet set that tries to match every single little jugginess that Diodes signal?
It won't try to do this because it's not worth it for it. It's not worth it adding so many wavelets to try to match every little thing. Every little thing that you see in the spectrum is removed by using the spectrum in the analysis. You know what the spectrum is. We don't look at the data as is. We look at the Whiten data, but take the spectrum into account. And effectively, if there's something at some frequency, some really high line at some frequency, then effectively this frequency is removed from the analysis by using the spectrum.
Okay, but then just to be a pain, so you could have a signal that is so weird that it looks exactly like what the unfiltered line, that light was noise or looks like. And so then you're penalizing trying to look for it.
Like the crab pulsar at 50 hertz or something.
That
would be hard to see, because anything that falls on these lines is really hard to see for any analysis, because the noise is so high, you can't see it. So this is an example for how Bayes wave reconstructed 1509-14. So Bayes wave is a big Markov chain Monte Carlo. It tries different combinations of wavelets, parameters, number of wavelets. It's a big chain. This is one instance from this chain. At some point, Bayes wave tried using these wavelets plotted around here. This is the Whiten strain as a function of time. It used about 4 to 5 wavelets. And then when you sum them, the full signal you get out of it is something that looks like that. Looks fairly close to 1509-14.
So if you allow the wavelet analysis to just have infinite frequency domain and infinite parameter space, surely you could reproduce every bump and wiggle in the plot. So what kind of filtering effectively is being done? Is there like a maximum frequency that you permit the wavelets to go to, or a minimum, like, maximum Q?
Yes, we have to restrict that. So first of all, about the frequency range, all these kind of algorithms are really limited by the frequency or time volume they're searching. You have to limit this to some extent. So Bayes wave is really good for this really high mass black holes that have a very short time and frequency duration. Then, on top of that, Bayes wave or any other algorithm has priors on its parameters. So you do end up imposing priors on the 5 parameters, the wavelets, depend on and on the number of parameters. And all these priors have been determined by trial and error, testing different signals, running on the real data, and computing backgrounds and understanding how backgrounds behave.
So what kind of priors do you have on the number of wavelets?
The number of wavelets is actually flat.
So it not log n, but flat in n?
Just flat between, I believe, 1 in 100 at this point.
That's your Occam's razor.
But you change. It changes.
Because if I wanted to fit a wavelet with different parameters with other wavelets, which is what your degeneracy is, wouldn't I typically need a very large number of them to get a good approximation? So
fit a signal that is just one wavelet?
Imagine I put in one wavelet and I wanted to fit it with another combination of wavelets.
It will use one wavelet then.
No. But we know it's degenerate because it's overcomplete, right?
Mm-hmm. But it's not worth it doing more wavelets. If it can fit it well with one wavelet, it will just use one. It won't add a second.
Is it based on evidence that you use to decide whether it's worth it or not?
Yes.
Okay, so that's what protects you from overcompetence.
Yes.
What is a Bayesian wavelet analysis? led us to use templates from GR. The third is to actually take the data and see how much you can extract from it by filtering, whitening, blah, blah. And it's interesting to compare these three approaches. You should give about the same answer. The first event is the best one.
It should give you about the same answer when your signal is really strong and you can see it. But then I tried to have this hierarchy in earlier slides, that when you use templates, you're very sensitive, you're less flexible. When you use wavelets, you're less sensitive, but you're very flexible. If you don't use any model and do some kind of correlation analysis from the data streams, you're even more flexible, but even less sensitive if something happens.
The other four events. Fine. The four events, the signal strength is not great compared to the first event. So there, it's important to distinguish the results from different three processes.
Yeah, absolutely. 15.914 is a 6 sigma excursion of the noise. You can do a correlation analysis here.
Do you extract a signal to noise ratio from this?
Yes, I will talk about this later. Okay, and this is the second comparison, more comprehensive comparison of this method to what the templates method gives. This is a plot from the 17.0104 paper, this time where you have the whitened data as a function of time in the two detectors, Hanford and Livingston. In the background, I hope you can see it's in light gray is the raw data, the real data the detector gave. And then you see two shaded regions. These two shaded regions are the posterior, is what we think the waveform looks like. The 90% credible intervals for the signal posterior, computing in two ways. With blue is with binary black hole templates. So the flagship analysis where you assume you know what you're looking for, you're using the solutions to general relativity to analyze the signal, and with orange is what you get with wavelets. So the wavelets reconstruct really well and agree really well with a template-based search when the signal is loud. The robustness was used as an independent verification of the binary black hole templates at the time of the analysis. Of course, you can see small differences. You can see this is probably the one that stands out the most. It's because wavelets do not overfit. Deep down, a Bayes wave and an algorithm like that needs to see the signal, be sure there's a signal there, in order to throw a wavelet and try to capture and try to model it. Binary black hole templates, on the other hand, don't need to do this. They see something here, they reconstruct it very well, and then they just extend the template all the way down to earlier times or earlier frequencies, even if they're not completely sure there is something there. They have been taught by numerical relativity and general relativity that there should be something there and they should go down there.
The data that you show is whitened.
This is whitened, yes. This is whitened, you can see the sigma here, and then to compute the strain, it was rescaled to the actual strain from some frequency around 100 hertz, I believe, to compute the strain on the left axis.
So which strain do you believe, the one from the wavelets or the binary black hole templates?
Which strain do I believe?
Yeah, because the one from wavelets are kind of higher.
Well, what I believe is a function of a lot of things. So this bands is what I believe. These are 90% credible bands. So I'm 90% sure that the signal, the true signal, is somewhere in there. When you talk about when the wavelets and the binary black hole disagrees, like in this region, then you start looking into your hypothesis, what the hypothesis that went into the analysis. If you believe that general relativity is correct and the templates are accurate, you believe this little bump here. If you have doubts and you don't want to make assumptions that general relativity is correct, you don't believe this little bump in there. So what you believe is, you always take your hypothesis as input before you make a judgment.
Close to the beak, they are different. There is a much bigger difference.
close to the peak, like here, they overlap at the 90% level. Everything overlaps.
The input would be perhaps the inference in how far the object is.
You doubt that the data is stationary. How can we rely on that?
It depends on the signal. For short signals like that, you can take a look at the time scale here.
Should go about 32 seconds.
2 seconds? 2 seconds is probably okay. There are a lot of techniques to calculate the power spectral density of the detector, which eventually is what widens the data and what assumes the data is stationary. And comparisons between the different techniques are what allow us to claim with confidence that 2 seconds, the detector doesn't change too much. If you talk about a month, the detector changes considerably, and the data is not stationary, and then you would have a problem. So but with 2 seconds for binary black holes, we're probably okay.
The total light, the time interval is 4,096 seconds.
Yes.
So you pull out 32 seconds. But if you chop up 32 seconds into 0.2 seconds bits, for example, then the pressure station around becomes, you have to take a bigger time.
There are two main approaches to calculating the power spectral density. The first is what you describe. You take a large chunk of data, and you do averages. You calculate the PSD you do 32 chunks of data of 4 seconds duration. You calculate the PSD from each of these different chunks, and then you average. And there is this method, which, of course, is less robust against non-stationarity, but it's more robust against, you know, taking 4 seconds of data and FFTing it. There are issues there if you only look at 4 seconds. There's a different method that looks only at these 4 seconds of data and nothing else and calculates the PSD from it. Comparison between these two and agreement between these two is what makes us confident that using two methods that assume completely different things about the noise and giving us basically the same answer, what makes us confident that the power spectral density is well estimated and it does indeed widen the data the way we expect it to.
If I use wavelets to fit the data and try to extract physics parameters, how much off will they be for the mass of black hole compared to if I would use BBH templates right at the beginning?
So this slightly variation of this question is what I'm going to talk about, but for a different signal, for post-merger signals from neutron star coalescences. So I'm going to answer the mass question now. After 15914, there were a lot of estimates from the masses of the system by using the wavelets. So people looked at the frequency evolution of the wavelets and tried to put bounds on the masses. Because they weren't using a strong prior for what the signal looks like, the analysis was less flexible, and they weren't getting as tight of a measurement as a template one. They were getting the correct answer still, but with a larger error bar than what a template-based search would give you. And there are follow-up papers to 15914 that go into this analysis and describe it, if you're interested. Okay, so that's most of what I had to say about data analysis, and I'm gonna try to switch to physics from now on and look at a specific system. And the system I'm going to apply this method to, phase wave, to reconstruct the signal, is a neutron star binary. So when they're far apart, neutron stars look like black holes or point particles. Nothing weird happens. We can use the same type of analysis for black holes. But when they get closer together, things start to become messier. The matter makes the evolution more complicated. There are tidal interactions between the stars. And when they finally touch and merge, what happens after that is a total mess, basically. Because there's matter, and matter complicates things. the system might collapse into a black hole and be very similar to a binary black hole coalescence, or it might give a short or long-lived remnant neutron star, which oscillates and emits a complicated signal here with a red line from a numerical simulation. The blue dotted for comparison is what you get in the point particle limit. If you forget that these are neutron stars and you assume that they are black holes, the gravitational wave signal looks very, very different. The reason this signal is interesting is because of its spectrum. So if you plot the spectrum as a function of frequency from one of these numerical simulations of a neutron star coalescence, you get something like looks like that, where you can easily, everyone can spot out this impressive feature here, a peak frequency. The neutron star, the remnant, rings at a characteristic frequency that is basically its dominant quadrupolar oscillation mode. And this feature here in the post-merger signal seems to be fairly robust. It's not hard to think that you have an object. It's oscillating at its fundamental F mode. And it's something that people in a lot of numerical simulations see and try to analyze and understand. There's a lot of ongoing work, of course, about subdominant modes and a lot of discussion. So what I'm mostly going to focus on here is this. Can we use Bayes-Wave to reconstruct the signal and measure the dominant peak frequency of the post-merger spectrum? From a de-analysis point of view, and from Bayes-Wave point of view, this is an ideal signal for it. This is a time frequency representation of the signal, time frequency decomposition here, and in the top panel is projected in the time domain, in the right panel is projected in the frequency domain. And notice two interesting things. First is that in the time domain, the signal doesn't look clean and predictable and well-behaved. It has the main oscillation mode, but there's all sorts of other features going on. This makes the signal very difficult to model exactly if you want to build a template to analyze it. The second thing to notice is the duration of the signal. The duration is of order milliseconds. I mentioned this earlier, that these type of searches are fairly severely limited by the time frequency volume they have to probe. It's really hard for Bayes-Wave to analyze a 10-minute signal because it has to probe a huge time frequency volume. But when your signal is short duration, order milliseconds, this is ideal for this unmodeled analysis. And an extra reason why we want to look into this problem is that the peak frequencies, the frequency at which the post-merger spectrum peaks, are important physically. People have been analyzing them for some time, and from the numerical simulations, they're recovering phenomenological universal-like relations between the peak frequency and various quantities that describe the in-spiral of the two neutron stars. Here's an example. Each dot here is a separate numerical simulation of a neutron star merger for different equations of state, different masses for the two systems. And what's plotted here is the peak frequency as a function of the radius of a non-rotating 1.6 solar mass neutron star with this equation of state. And the relation is fairly linear, it's fairly universal. It tells you that if you measure the peak frequency, you might be able to measure the radius of a 1.6 solar mass neutron star. And there's another relation that people have suggested. This time is between the peak frequency and the tidal deformability. The tidal deformability of the star is a parameter that tells you how easy or hard it is to deform a star in the presence of a tidal field. Both of these quantities, the radius and the tidal deformability, would be very interesting for nuclear physicists, because if we can measure them and tell them, give them an idea of the value of these parameters, it might be able to tell us more about what the equation of state of nuclear matter looks like.
So can you explain this a little bit more? It looks like to me that what you're saying is that it's almost useless for nuclear series, right? Because your data is absolutely insensitive to the equation of state. So particular radius is universal compared to the peak frequency. So how can, you know, how can I get any information about the equation of state of nuclear matter from this?
Yes, what data analysis can give you is your measurement of this. Say that you have measured that the peak frequency is 2.5 kilohertz.
But I thought you told us that, you know, pretty much different equation of state still lie on this curve. So it's not sensitive to the equation of state.
Right. So we measure 2.5 kilohertz. And then we go to this relation, and we say that this came from a interstar with a radius of 13 kilometers. That is still interesting. If we can measure the masses from the in-spiral and measure the radius from the post-measure or any other information, this still gives us information. The step that does not include the equation of state is going from here to here. The interpretation of this number will include the equation of state at the end of the day.
So I guess what you're trying to say is that as I'm changing the equation of state, so my data will move along this curve.
Yes.
But just only along this curve.
These different colors are numerical activity simulations from different equation state, different masses.
I see. So if I have fixed peak frequency and change the equation of state, I'm going to be moving along the curve. So you would need an independent, as you were saying, an independent measurement for the radius.
You can see the same thing here. You can't quite see it. But the data they have is colored according to the equation state they use in their simulations. You see that the different, use different simulations, but still the data more or less follows on this universal relation.
Let me just be going to clarify. So this is how, if you want, DIO will provide you with a measurement of the radius through this map. And then you go to your equation state and say, which equation state for the masses that LIGO tell me, give me that radius.
Well, isn't that amazing that the equation of state picks up just a sum?
Yeah, but I mean, it's not. It's very constrained. So the system is so special by the time they're touching.
So you basically.
There is a strong memory of what were the radius of the stars.
So it's a one parameter equation of state. Then you get all.
No, the equation of state is complicated. It's a one parameter thing, relation between frequency and radius. Then. What equation state produces that's a different story.
Is this frequency essentially the frequency at contact?
No.
No, this, yeah. This is the frequency of the main oscillation mode of the post-merger. Remnants, it has to do with its density. It's not the frequency at contact. And Lewis was telling me of a calculation yesterday to show that it's about twice. Contact frequency, 2.7 times.
That's rough. But it's, I mean, so because the system is so constrained, so the stiffness of the equation of state will allow these objects to come into each other. But it's very uniquely determined how much it will go through by the equation of state and the radius. But the radius is also equation of state, so there's single information.
So I'm running a bit out of time, so I'll jump ahead to the analysis. So I will lead you through an example of what happens when we have a signal like that and we try to analyze it with phase wave. So we do what data analysts have been doing all these years. When they don't have data, we make our own signals. We inject simulated signals in the data streams and analyze them end to end as if it was a real signal. So we take a simulation with a certain equation of state, given it by these papers. This is the time series. In blue is the full simulation data that was given to us. In orange is just the post-merger part. And if you look at it in the Fourier domain, the spectrum, this is the spectrum as a function of frequency. You see the full simulation in blue, just the post-merger phase where you clearly see the peak in the spectrum, and as a reference, I've also plotted what you'd get from the in-spiral. If you assume a point particle system, and they just orbit around each other, and you have a very long in-spiral, the blue spectrum is what you would get from this phase. So we are injecting this data which basically means we're taking this time series, we're adding simulated Gaussian noise to it, and we're analyzing it as if it was real detector data. And we give it to Bayes-Wave, and that's what Bayes-Wave gives us back. It gives us back a reconstruction from what the waveform looks like, plus error bars. So this is 50 and 90% credible intervals for the reconstruction. On the y-axis, you have the whitened strain for the data as a function of time. In the back, you really can't see the data. You can't see the gray. But there is a very light gray for what the actual data is in the back. But the green you can see here is what the injected waveform is, what the simulation tells us the gravitational wave looks like. And the purple is median and 50 and 90% credible interval bands for what Bayes-Wave thinks this reconstruction is.
So do you lose anything if you do not include the INSPARF? The latter part of the INSPARF?
So we have tried just putting a window here after the amplitude. It doesn't change much. And every quantity I'm going to talk about, like the signal-to-noise ratio or the peak frequencies, how we extract them, is done after we have windowed out everything. We give everything to the simulation for Bayes-Wave to analyze it because it's easier for it if there's some discontinuity or we have to pick the window appropriately, make sure it doesn't freak out. But we analyze the full thing, but then only use the post-merger to do anything interesting with it. Just some numbers for this reconstruction. It used about 4 or 5 wavelets. Decided on that number on its own, which means about 15 to 20 parameters for the signal model, because each wavelet has 5 parameters. And how good the fit was is here. So this is the posterior for the overlap. The overlap is basically an inner product between the signal and your model. The closer the overlap is to 1, the better you have reconstructed the signal. The closer it is to 0, the worse of a job you have done. And in this case, it achieves fairly good overlaps of 0.85 and 0.9. But what we mostly care about, of course, is the spectrum. That's where you can see everything. Data analysis is in the frequency domain. Staring at the spectrum will tell you everything you need to know. So again, power as a function of frequency. You kind of see the injected data here in the background. This is just Gaussian noise, essentially. The straight black line is the power spectrum, the power spectral density for the detector, the sensitivity of the detector. And in green, you have the injected spectrum, what the true spectrum is. And the purple bands is how Bayes-Wave reconstructed it. Median, 50% credible interval, and 90% credible interval. The important thing, of course, is this. We can very well reconstruct this peak over there. So we can use this reconstruction to measure the peak frequency. As a side note, though I'm not going to really discuss this anymore, we can also extract other features like that if they are loud enough. So by using this reconstruction, of course, we can measure the peak frequency. Each of these, this is a posterior. Each of these is a sample from the chain. Each sample from the chain is a waveform. Each waveform has a spectrum, and from this spectrum, we can find its maximum and call this the peak frequency. And that's the posterior for the peak frequency. Actually, unnormalized posterior, because they're just counts for the peak frequency, the injected value and what Bayes-Wave gets in purple. So for a strong signal, a good measurement, we can extract the frequency of the post-merger spectrum to a fairly good accuracy. Any questions?
What sort of sense whether or not the bias is towards low frequencies or high frequencies?
I will discuss this now. So the next step, this was just an example to show you how the analysis is done. Next step is to systematically study three representative equation state, a stiff, a moderate, and a soft equation state, and see how the sensitivity depends on the specifics of the equation state. So we select three equations of state, a stiff one with a peak at fairly low frequencies, a moderate, and a soft equation of state. And we analyze. We create the same system, but with different equations of state. So we pick the same masses, the same sky location, everything else is the same, but the equation of state. We analyze the signal, and we compare the results to draw conclusions about the equation of state dependence on the results. So let's start with the most stiff equation of state. We analyze the spectrum, and we get a posterior for the peak frequency. When the signal, and here is the injected value. As of the quantity we use to quantify how strong a signal is a signal-to-noise ratio. So at a signal-to-noise ratio of 3, there is no measurement. The signal is not strong enough. Phase wave cannot reconstruct the signal, and therefore cannot extract the peak frequency. The resulting posterior is just flat and uninformative. It's the same as its prior, because we haven't learned anything. As you increase the SNR, you start getting a bump. And as you increase the SNR more and more, the bump gets more and more prominent. And eventually, at SNR 10, you get a fairly decent measurement of the peak frequency. You get a posterior tied around the injected value. And yes?
Yeah, I shouldn't interrupt you now.
I'm about to answer Paul's question on the shift to the posterior. So you realize, you see here and notice a systematic shift. The reason this is happening, that there are two effects at play, and one dominates. The one that dominates is the fact that the peak frequency is not constant in time. The binary, the remnant evolves a little bit, and the frequency changes. As a result, this peak is not symmetric. If the frequency was constant, the peak would be exactly symmetric. And we're trying to model this signal with some Gaussians, constant frequency, for which the spectrum is just Lorentzian and it is symmetric. So given the current situation, what the algorithm will try to do is extract as much of the signal as it can, given what it has. And what it has is symmetric peaks. So it will shift the wavelet a little bit to the left because there is more power here than here, on the left and the right. The result is that the peak of the wavelet will be shifted a bit to the left. So this asymmetry in the peak is what's causing this shift. And there are some ways, maybe some ways around it. There are versions of Bayes wave that use wavelets that evolve in frequency too. And we have tried using some of them, but so far they haven't given better results than this. So far we're using just this, knowing that if the peak is asymmetric, you'll get a small shift.
Could you just define the peak not to be the maximum, some sort of weighted average?
Then you'd have to assume what the equation of state is, because a different equation of state has a different asymmetry. This equation of state, the asymmetry is a bit more to the right, so the posterior is shifted a bit to the right.
Yeah, but I just mean, like, for a given equation of state, you define to be just the maximum, the value where the signal has its maximum, but
yes.
Like some sort of weighted average of the...
If you could make some assumption about the equation state, some modeling, some idea of how this bias behaves, you could incorporate this into the analysis. But deciding to be completely agnostic, you end up with something like that, a shift that depends on exactly what you're analyzing. So this is the result for a different equation of state. The shift is a bit more to the right. But again, you get a nice measurement for the peak frequency. And the final equation of state, again, you get something similar. The peak is slightly asymmetric. You get a small shift in the posterior. But again, as always, you start from an uninformative measurement. It's just your prior, and then slowly it starts rising. A peak starts rising as your signal becomes louder and louder. Is this thing working?
That's not.
Oh.
Ten minutes.
Okay. And just putting them all together, the final word is that if you compare the three plots, notice, of course, the different x-axis because they are different peaks. At SNR3, this equation of state already has a small bump. This is just a prior. This is just a prior. Then the conclusion is that for more soft equations of state, given a signal strength, it's easier to measure the peak. For here, at SNR4, you can already have a fairly good measurement of the peak frequency. For more stiff equations of state, you need to go more up to SNR5.
This is SNR3 in the after merger?
In the post merger, yes.
What would that be in the overall SNR?
That will depend quite sensitively on the simulations that you use to inject, but it will be something of the order of 100.
I was thinking that the softer one will give the least title from a modulation prior to merger. Could this complement that you now say something of the equation state, but the tides would have given you enough information already?
Yes, it's slightly both. So on the one hand, the in-spiral will give you some information, the post-merger will give you some complementary information, or even might give you information because the equation of state depends on the temperature, the equation of state might be slightly different, so it will give you more information.
Yeah.
That's not just complementary, but even enhancing. On the other hand, the second point is that this measurement can be so good if SNR5 that it is competitive to tidal deformability measurements with all the usual caveats of how much you can trust the simulations. But hand wave, if you do a back of the envelope calculation, the bounds are of comparable magnitude.
So why is it easier to measure high frequencies? I mean, just naively think LIGO is less sensitive than higher frequencies, so it's harder to measure things.
Remember, what I'm fixing is the SNR. So
right,
what I'm fixing...
What
I'm fixing is how strong the signal is compared to the noise. So this needs to be brought further up in strain to give a signal-to-noise ratio of 5 than this. The reason why higher frequencies are easier to measure is because when the frequency is higher, it oscillates more, so you accumulate more phase. And when you accumulate more phase, it's easier to measure this phase. Much easier to measure 10 cycles than one cycle, basically.
But if you just fix maybe the SNR of the in-spiral, then this would be reversed.
If you fix the SNR of the in-spiral, then I don't know if it will be reversed, but it will be more complicated because you're adding another layer of complication in this comparison. So yes, it wouldn't be as clean of a comparison. Okay, with this peak measurement, going back to the kind of universal relations that we can use, numerical simulation people have found, we can, with a measurement of the peak frequency, measure the radius. And that's where modeling creeps in. So far, everything is model independent. We have a very robust way to estimate the peak frequency. Once we start assuming information that we got from numerical simulation, modeling uncertainty creeps in. And we want to be as systematics-free as possible. So what you can do in cases like that, when you're handed a universal relation that has an error, you kind of believe the relation, but you're worried because there is an error, what you can do is you can always incorporate this error in your analysis. And based on inference, you can just model the systematic error you have and marginalize over it. And you're guaranteed to get the correct answer at the end. So this is an example of how this thing works. We took the data. Points here are just data from numerical simulations. And if you plot it in peak frequency divided by the total mass as a function of the radius, you get something that looks kind of universal. And we fit that with a model. In this case, we use a very simple, naive linear model. You can do something more complicated and more fancy. This is just an example to show how this method works. So we modeled that data. And I'm showing here the maximum likelihood and median modeling of the data, plus 50% and 90% credible intervals. So that gives you an estimate for the error in the universal relation. And you can use that estimate to marginalize over the error and make sure that your result at the end of the day is correct. And this is how this thing works. if we take the measurement on the peak frequency and convert it to a measurement of the radius, we get a posterior for the radius. If we take the universal relation given to us at face value, we assume it's exact, then you get a posterior that looks like this. It's a function of the SNR. The error in the universal relation has completely ruined the analysis, because we are able to measure the radius so well that the systematics dominate our statistical uncertainty for what the radius is. But if, on the other hand, we don't just assume that the relation is exact and we marginalize over the uncertainty in the relation, you get something that looks like that, which now becomes broad enough that it encompasses the correct injected value. Of course, the measurement is not as tight, but the measurement is correct. It encompasses the correct value. And you can get similar results for the other equations of state, but the basic conclusion is that systematic uncertainties will dominate in the end, no matter how well you measure the peak frequency. If you want to go to the radius, you will be limited by systematic uncertainties, which is where better modeling of these relations and better numerical simulations that account for more things could be helpful, because data analysis cannot push any further when the systematics dominate the measurement. How much time do I have?
A few minutes.
So I will probably skip and just mention that we can also measure the energy. If you take the reconstruction and integrate over all frequencies, this is the energy emitted in the post-merger phase, and we can measure it from the reconstruction and get posteriors for the energy. But I will move to the final part, which has to do with the fact that these things, the SNRs I talked about, SNR 10 in the post-merger, is really low. The chances of getting such a screaming loud event are fairly low. It might happen, it might not happen. What is better is if what realistically we'll have is a population of signals. We won't just have one signal, one very loud. You have a population of really low SNR signals that you can barely see, but you might be able to extract something from them. So if we look into this, what we did is we took a large number of signals, we placed them uniformly in the sky and in the universe in distance and sky location, and we analyzed them, a large number of them. And in this case, I'm going to show results from this waveform with this equation of state, but it is generic. The analysis is generic, and you can extrapolate the results to different equation of state. So first, we just analyze the population. This is the median overlap, 90% credible interval for the overlap, median over all the population. So we have 500 systems per SNR. We analyze all these systems. We calculate the overlap, the credible interval in the overlap, and we take the median over all of these systems to find more or less an average behavior, what you would get if you see an average system. And we get, as expected, as the SNR increases, we get better and better reconstructions, because Bayes-Wave can use more and more wavelets to reconstruct the signal, and we get fairly good overlaps of 80 and 90%. We can plot the same kind of functions for the peak frequency to estimate the sensitivity we have for the peak frequency. So again, this is median 90% credible intervals as a function of the post-merger frequency for a large number of systems. At low SNR, Bayes-Wave does not reconstruct much of the signal, so the width is very large, is basically equal to the width of the prior. We're getting back the prior, we're not getting any measurement. But once Bayes-Wave starts reconstructing, the signal, the SNR increases, you can get a fairly decent measurement. An interesting thing that comes out of this is that here, this plot, if you have the error in the measurement, so just a 90% credible interval as a function of the SNR, this is just different way of showing this plot essentially. At low SNRs, when you don't reconstruct anything, the posterior is as wide as the prior. 90% of the posterior is 90% of the prior. You haven't learned anything, no harm done. But once base width starts reconstructing, the error decreases with increasing SNR, and it achieves a performance of 1 over the SNR. That's the rate at which it increases. This is the theoretical performance you expect from match filtering, and base width gets fairly close to this performance for when it starts reconstructing the signal, when it starts seeing the signal and reconstructing it. And once it starts reconstructing, we get a measurement error, the order of something like 10 hertz for a single system. But the interesting thing is what happens, not when you get one real loud event, when you get lots of less loud events, sub-threshold systems. In this case, the Bayesian framework has a very simple way of combining information from the different systems. What you do is the posterior for some parameter, any parameter you want, given two data sets, so given two events, will just be the prior times two instances of the likelihood. So you take two events, you analyze them separately, you multiply the likelihoods, multiply by one instance of the prior, and that's the joint posterior. So we did that with a population I showed earlier. We took all these systems and we combined the information from all of them. And this is just an example of what you get when you have loud signals. So all of these signals are SNR5, they're fairly loud. On the left, you see the individual posteriors for each of these. Actually, I only plotted 100 because 500 would be a bit too much. So 100 different posteriors for each different event. You combine all these posteriors with how Bayes' theorem tells you you should combine things, and you get a tight measurement for the peak frequency. And as a rule of thumb, 100 SNR5 signals are basically equivalent to one SNR50 signal. But again, you might argue that SNR5 is a bit too loud, and we get 100 SNR5 results. In that case, what you would hope to do is be able to extract the same information from a more realistic population set. So in this case, we have 500 uniformly distributed signals. So we took signals uniformly distributed in volume between 5 and 200 megaparsecs, and we combined the information from all of this. Most of them are fairly quiet signals below SNR1. You have some signals that are higher, but the combination of all these together, all these posteriors that look fairly uninformative, and I'm not really sure you can see them, but they're gray posteriors here that each one on its own is fairly uninformative, all of them will add together to give you a good measurement of the peak frequency. So, yeah, that's not working. This is basically what I had to say. The takeaway message is that we can combine a large number of sub-threshold sources to get a good measurement. Also, we have ways to analyze unexpected signals. We have ways to analyze signals that are hard to model, signals that are too loud to accurately model with what we have today. So everything is going well. Thank you.
The last combination, so that theoretically you would obtain square root.
Sorry?
The theoretical expectation of how much your SNR grows as you more events is square root of n, or is it?
You cannot extract this from here because these are events of different SNRs, which is why we did the analysis with this, and here it goes as square root n.
One general comment, maybe not terribly relevant. For neutron stars, we have to worry about equations of state, mass versus radius, or radius. For black holes, all we know is the mass and the spatial radius. We know nothing about what was on inside. to an analysis of the measured data. So when you compare the two, it's just one neutron stars we know about, black holes we don't know about, and yet we analyze both sets of data.
Similar kind of analysis can be applied to black hole systems. So what you're saying is that if there's physics we don't understand in black holes, then this could change the waveform. So this is something that is being actively pursued from the original 15914 analysis. Something that people tried was take the signal, take the data, subtract what the template tells us it is, what general relativity tells us this signal is, and then run Bayes' wave on the residuals and see if Bayes' wave finds anything left behind. And it didn't find anything. So if something was there, it was sub-threshold for this system.
So you're saying that you eventually distinguish between a parameter star and a classical black hole. A classical black hole just has a singularity in the center, and nothing in between that and the source of gravity. Whereas a parameter star is a quantum physics compound object.
Yeah, absolutely. And these kind of analyses are actively being pursued and actively are going on in LIGO right now. So we are confident that at least we're not completely blind to anything weird that might happen. Can't promise we'll see everything, but there's certain classes of weird things that can happen that we will see.
A gravastar, just comment. So the comment, a gravastar is nothing but wishful thinking at this time. There's nothing we can do. No, there is nothing we can do. There is no theory that says how you're going to form them, nor how we're going to merge them. So there is nothing we can do to test it.
It's
all that sounds too good. It's nice, but there is nothing you can write down. So people have written down a line of gravastar for a static case, not answering the question how they do. So we don't have anything.
How do you write down about black holes classical GL? It's a singularity center.
Yeah, but after the horizon, everything is fine. We know they're stable. Once we have them, we can merge them, we can go through and predict where the signal is. We cannot do the same thing with gravastar. So I don't think we're going to be able to test gravastar. We're going to be able to say these objects are consistent with GR, or maybe they are not. But from there to say they would be gravastars, there's a long way because we really don't know what a gravastar is.
Those who produce gravastars probably disagree with
you. I'm on the record saying gravastars are a piece of fidgets of people's imagination, and they should do the work to then now try to face the music that LIGO is bringing forward. Because now it's been contested, and so far it has been a nice thing to play around with, but there's nothing we have to go and try to use LIGO to test them, for sure.
Well, at least they put the surface outside the horizon, so, you know. There are some people who don't even do that.
Okay, thanks, Catherine.
Thank you.